and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your family, your community, your personal well-being, and what's going on in our total environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the ways that we contribute to or detract from the ecological balance and nourishment living essence offered to us by our habitat, this beloved earth. Each week on the show, we discuss different facets of that with advocates, thought leaders, scientists, authors, poets, filmmakers, and all sorts of people who can contribute different ways of our coming to a path of healing and wholeness and care for our planet and each other. I am really delighted to have on today's show a wonderful guest. Her name is Lynn Gale, Ph.D. She's an Algonquin Anishinaabekwe. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Lynn. You can correct me if there's a, you know, better pronunciation. Lynn is an advocate, an artist, writer, and an outspoken critic of colonial law and policies that harm Indigenous women, men, children, and land. She resides in Canada and has been a really amazing activist in looking at the laws and governances enacted, encoded in Canadian law as they impact Indigenous peoples. Her earlier 2014 book, which we'll talk about a bit on the show, is The Truth That Wampum Tells, My Debuwin on the Algonquin Land Claims Process. Her more recent 2017 book, Claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit, is about her journey deeper into Indigenous knowledge and her long work to defeat the Indian and Northern Affairs Canada's unstated paternity policy, which was, which contained sex discrimination, and she actually was able to prevail in her long suit to do that. Lynn is also studied. She has a very rich background because she also studied chemical technology in college prior to gaining her Ph.D. in Indigenous Studies. Her undergraduate work was in psychology and cultural anthropology. And, of course, this deep awareness infuses all her work. She's been published in a whole variety of different publications, has published 4 books, 17 academic journal publications, and over 120 community publications. She regularly blogs and appears on television and radio. I'm really honored to have her joining us today on Connect the Dots. Welcome, Lynn Gale.
Kwe. Thank you, Allison, for having me. Much appreciated.
Well, it's really great to have you here. You really, your story really exemplifies, commitment and persistence and caring and warriorship in action. Let's begin with talking about your most recent book, as well as, I guess, what we would narrowly call your cultural identity. Your book is Claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit. Can you tell us a little bit about your tribal background and your work to establish your rights as an Algonquin Anishinaabe?
Sure. So I'm what's now called Canada. So we don't use the term tribal. We talk about nations. And so I'm an Algonquin Anishinaabe from the Ottawa River Valley, but I've never lived there. So the Ottawa River, on one side of the river is Ontario, and the other side of the river is the province of Canada. And Canada's parliament buildings squat on our traditional territory, although we've never ceded that territory to Canada. So that's where I'm from, but I've never lived there due to processes of colonization and genocide. My ancestors were pushed out of their territory, and I was born and raised in, probably better to say born and grew up in Toronto, taking frequent trips into First Nation, Pequawkinagon First Nation, which is where my grandmother and great-grandmother are from. So my great-grandmother was asked to leave the reservation because she married a man who was only Indigenous through his mother line. And through sex discrimination, my great-grandmother and her children were removed from the reservation. And that was, you know, a long time ago. I think it was in the before the 1930s where she, when she was removed. And then in 1985, they amended the Indian Act to bring it in line with Canada's charter. And through the process of amending the Indian Act, while they did resolve some of the sex discrimination, they actually left in some, and as well as created new forms of sex discrimination. And the one that I addressed was the issue of unknown and unstated paternity, where if a man, if a child's father was not on a birth certificate, the assumption at the level of practice in Indian affairs was to assume the child was a, the father was a white man, and many children have lost Indian status through that. But after 32 years, I was successful in defeating that policy. So that's a little bit about who I am. Now, my book, Claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit, this doesn't come from my PhD work. It comes most, from my journey into Indigenous knowledge and reflecting on it deeply and giving back to community people.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about, where that took you? You had been raised with some exposure to your people, but also, kind of not fully immersed. And so you went on a kind of journey of rediscovery, did you not? And can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Sure, thanks. So, Indigenous knowledge is different. It offers different things than I'm going to say legal and scientific positivism. So I was working in doing environmental testing for things like PCBs and dioxins and furans through electron capture, gas chromatograph, and mass spectrometers. And I worked in that area for about 12 years, and the technology was quite sophisticated, of course, to measure pollutants at the ppm level, parts per billion level. I realized when I thought about it deeply that it really wasn't changing human behavior, that there was a sophisticated way of knowing and identifying and quantifying pollutants, but it wasn't changing our behavior. And I left that position and then started in university and looking for answers. And I started in psychology, but again, it was just it wasn't answering my questions. It was still rooted in the people and blaming the people type of model of understanding. And so then I turned towards anthropology, and from anthropology was directed into my Anishinaabe worldview. And I started more deeply thinking about it, listening and reading from scholars and thinkers and the best writing. And through that process, I was, again, thinking very deeply about the nature of the human condition. And through that process, I came to a place where I really valued Indigenous knowledge and its sophisticated nature. And so then the book is about my journey into Indigenous knowledge and looking at things such as the nature of the human spirit, where is it, who has it, where is it located, type of thing. And I just learned a lot. And what was really helpful was I was able to use a comparison, a way of thinking. I was comparing it to Western laboratory science as well as legal positivism, because, you know, I was moving through the court system at the same time. And I learned that, you know, objectivity and facts and they are not really the place where you can get truth and knowledge.
And yet we in the West rely on them. You know, if it isn't proven by science, it's thought not to be exist. But if science is either corrupted or fails to kind of add up all of the different, for example, toxins that people are exposed to and look at synergistic effects, there are just huge omissions in our, you know, kind of one-by-one approach to science. Could you, kind of define a little bit more for me and our listeners? Two things. One, you mentioned that you found the psychological approach to blame the people. Can you maybe expand on that a little bit and, you know, kind of describe how that's your perspective, and what you see there? Because I think in the Western mind, there's kind of an understanding that, you know, psychology could be a helper or a refuge. So I'd love to hear your perspective on that. And also what you describe as legal positivism. Positivism, which, what do you mean by kind of those two things? Because I think that'll help kind of support, you know, the journey that, listeners' understanding of the journey that you've taken.
Sure. So in terms of psychology, I felt like it was focusing too much on the individual and their symptoms and diagnosing the and coming up with a category or I think it's called a diagnosis versus looking at society and the structures in society. So what I've come to understand that a lot of psychological illness and even issues of disability are really because of a sick society versus a sick person. The person is just responding. It's a normal response to an abnormal situation in most cases. So I think if we're really going to look at the issues and resolve the issues, we have to stop labeling people and focusing on people and look at society. So that's what I meant by psychology is too narrow and focuses on the person and resolving the person.
Right. Sure.
Yeah, and so of course the having a diagnosis is useful, but it doesn't solve the issue. In terms of legal positivism, well, it's what I mean by that is this idea of relying on objectivities and facts and artifacts and removing subjectivity and experiential knowledge and morality. So that's what I mean by that. And it's the same thing with scientific positivism, that they rely on this narrow understanding of knowledge and where is it. They're both really just methods of truthing and gaining knowledge, which, of course, has huge limitations. But a lot of people turn to the law and to Western science, and they engage in idolatry, holding it up as having a truth, the absolute truth, and nothing but the truth. But actually, that's incorrect. When you remove subjectivity and morality and emotional knowledge from the knowledge-seeking journey, you actually fail to capture what is most important. So when I start thinking about indigenous knowledge philosophy, and I learning about the teachings and beliefs and the morality, I realized that indigenous knowledge is not just about fluffs and feathers and caring for the land, although caring for the land is crucial. It's not just about environmental science is what I mean by that. That indigenous knowledge is a complete knowledge system with assumptions and beliefs and ways of knowing and ways of being. The Western world calls that, ontology, axiology, epistemology, methodology. But in an indigenous world view, we would just talk about a knowledge bundle where all those relationships are there. And we wouldn't extract out our beliefs and our assumptions in order to gain a truth. And in the situation that we did, we'd be very well aware of what we were doing, that we were removing some of the truth. And so what I think, to contrast the two, I know there's a huge limitations to contrast things, but indigenous knowledge, philosophy, values, sacred beliefs, whereas Western science and legal positivism extracts them out, and that's the issue right there.
And also, I mean, I think, you know, when you talk about extracting out morality or ethics, for example, you know, if you take those out of the equation, you know, it's like the laboratory setting, you know, does not really assess, except perhaps at, you know, a narrow biochemical level, the impact on people, the impact on communities, the impact on the earth. There's like no way of providing ethical safeguards, and we can see that certainly running rampant in, you know, our current government. You know, where is the morality, where is the ethics, and where is the, you know, and in following those systems, you know, I mean, there's this basic human question that I think is kind of rising in louder and louder in volume for people who are caring about other people and about the earth. You know, where is the morality? Who, why is this kind of keep marching forward? Who, you know, who isn't pulling out all the stops to sort of intervene? And it's because there's this kind of numbification, you know, numbing or bifurcation or, you know, where these considerations, you know, are not given a place. I mean, they've been excised from our societal choices and judgments and decision making, and I, you know, to me, that's like what you're speaking to. It's like, how did this happen?
Yeah. It's a good teaching for Anishinaabe teaching is that you always walk your knowledge back to creation, and I think that's really it's, so even if you are in the laboratory and you find something quite phenomenal, then you're expected to walk it back to creation. So, for example, walk it back to your moral beliefs and see, is this the right thing to put out there? Is this in the broader context of our worldview? Is this real, legitimate, valid, moral knowledge? Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. So in my book, that's part of the thing, well, a huge thing I talk about, really, is it's, again, my book is Claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit, and it is published with the University of Regina Press. But what I want to say about your response, your question, your words there was, issue of morality, and I think what's really important to value when you're thinking about indigenous knowledge and how it differs from legal and scientific positivism is that this whole idea that knowledge is only in the mind is really inadequate and has limitations. I mean, there are Western models such as Freud's model of the iceberg and I think Carl Jung's model of the cork floating in the ocean, that the cork and the tip of the iceberg is the conscious mind, but below it is much, it's a bigger system there, our subconscious knowledge, our embodied knowledge, our innate knowledge. It's bigger than what our mind has, and this is the value of indigenous knowledge and Anishinaabe knowledge. What we bring to the discussion is that when we raise our children, we teach them how to sing and pray and dance for the earth and for the water, and we embody in them that rhythm, that love for the earth, and that reverence for the earth. And then as they grow up and move into a conscious understanding of who they are as a human being, they already have that knowledge embodied within them. And so they're just learning it in a different way now because they're conscious of their mind and conscious of their worldview and their culture. And what's really quite phenomenal about embodying within or within the landscape of our children is that when their mind fails them, when they're depressed or when they're sad or when they're excited, when they're frustrated, when somebody dies, when their mind fails them, their body remembers.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we raise our children today within the context of state nationalism and we put them in these schools where they're singing, you know, "O Canada" in Canada, "O Canada," and flying that flag, that daily ritual, that has a huge impact on in who they are. It sits within their body. It sits within their consciousness. So then on Canada Day or in a situation of war, they are just so much in love with the idea of being a Canadian, they'll do silly things. And yet when corporations pollute water, they won't stand up for the water.
Mm-hmm. Because so they haven't been worshiping the water in an embodied sense from early on. Is that what you're
saying? Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, so reverence for the water and reverence for the land, it starts pre-birth, I would say, you know, with parents singing to their babies. And I guess to give you a good something that may help in thinking about this is oftentimes I'm asked by teachers how they can, you know, bring in caring for the water into the curriculum. And I have to be quite honest and frank with them in saying reverence for the water is not a teachable moment. Reverence for the water is a life way.
Uh-huh.
And you know, if you want to teach children the reverence, or school children the reverence for the water in a teachable moment or in the classroom, that's like an after the fact repair or fix. You know, kind of like monitoring and measuring, quantifying pollutants after the fact. You have to get it at its source, and so we have to embody within children reverence for the land and the water.
Mm-hmm. That makes so much sense. You know, I had an experience just recently where I was with a small group of people. We were in a high place where you could see out over land to the water and the sky and, you know, sacred lands beyond. And it was really extraordinary. And one of the people came up to me and we had just this amazing broad horizon, beautiful view of, you know, what was really right there beneath our feet. And this woman, and, you know, my inclination would have been to, you know, open my heart and you know, maybe say a silent prayer for the earth and its living creatures or something, or, you know, put my wishes in my heart, you know, allow them to flow up at that moment. And somebody came up to me and started talking about an artwork of a sea landscape from a different location that she had seen. And I was just kind of astounded because it was like, to me, this illustrates the idea of the kind of mental concepts we learn to internalize in Western culture, where, you know, instead of being able to actually be present right there, you know, in this extraordinary place, there was like a different recollection was interposed, and it was kind of alike to the experience in that it was another seascape that she was picturing, but it was like the human interpretation of it, or, you know, this other thing was right in the way of both, you know, of her actually looking at where we were in the present moment, and also in her talking about it, I, you know, would have preferred, like, silence myself to just commune rather than, you know, having a kind of a story that's kind of in the way, you know, in some kind of way. So to me, that really, I thought of that when you described this because it typifies how we have learned to kind of block our own connection, even when, you know, it's right there before us, and instead interpose a human idea of some kind or other.
Yes, yes, or that person just has a need to talk a lot. You know, some people, that's how they learn, right?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm probably one of those people too, so.
yeah, likewise. But I just want to say something more about beliefs and assumptions. I find that a lot of people don't value sacred beliefs and assumptions. They just discredit them or they push them aside and say that's just a belief. Well, the thing is sacred beliefs that shape, you know, they shape who we are or how we think. So sacred beliefs are far more rational and sustainable than the economic paradigm and the destruction that it's unloading, right, or unfolding. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I think that there's this really really huge need for us to challenge people to say, stop discrediting reverence for the land and water and stop discrediting beliefs and the sacred, that they do shape human behavior and they do shape human thinking. And this idea that knowledge is only, it's not moral and it's only found in objectivity and facts is actually what is very dangerous and is destroying the earth and the water.
That's true. And it, too, is a belief. It's not like that's a known fact throughout time. There's no humility in failing to recognize that all of these things that we've been taught and, you know, assume are correct, these are beliefs and assumptions.
Yeah, that itself is a belief, exactly. But I think a lot of people can't think or don't think conceptually, and also I think people are too busy to think.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the economic paradigm, right? Making people work 5 days a week where they only have come home and have to do dinner, and then, you know, on the weekend they're taking care of the kids and shopping. So a lot of people are much too busy to do the thinking that they need to do. But I also think that we live in a very anti-intellectual society where people don't want to listen to the intellectuals. They'd rather listen to sports heroes and movie stars. And that's really unfortunate, right, that people have come to the place where they don't like their intellectuals, and what they do is they fight and debate with them or they put them down or project off of them. In the clan system of governance for the Anishinaabe people, and I do talk about it in my book, is everybody has gifts and particular ways of knowing, and each is valued. So an intellectual is of equal value as a woodchopper, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a barrier to asking people to value the sacred. I think also the church has been harmful in that sense as well.
How so?
Well, I think the institute. Well, you know, we know all the stories about the abuse, I think the sexism and the abuse in the institution, the abuse of power, has harmed people. And people don't. They just don't believe in the sacred. They believe in the dollar more. They worship the dollar. The rituals that people are engaging in are like. For example, shopping, that seems to be the, instead of praying and dancing, they're shopping and spending money, and I think secular beliefs, secular rituals, people aren't recognizing the power of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? A lot of people, myself included, their body shoots endorphins when they go shopping and buy a new purse, when really what they should be doing is singing and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
But the economic paradigm won't let you know that, unless it serves their purpose in some way.
Mm-hmm. Is singing and dancing still something that's, you know, kind of a part of life or actively pursued in the indigenous nations with which, is that tradition been revived? Is it alive? I mean, the whole thing about music and dance being like the most healing things that we have, I totally experience that, but I'm just wondering: do people still gather? Are there still dances? How is that? You know, has that been sort of stifled, or is, you know, what's the status of that right now in the tribes, nations? You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in Canada, our cultural traditions were criminalized. You know, I think it started in the 1880s. And it was even, you know, made illegal for us to hire lawyers for our land rights for example. But I don't think the dances and the songs and the ceremonies are completely died. Of course they didn't completely die. But today you see it mostly in powwows. But the Madeoan society is still up and still has lodges where the Madeoan society were are spiritual and cultural keepers, and they're still alive, and there's a well, and they do, you know, ceremonies and singing and dancing is a big part of it, of that. So it's still we still are teaching children how to sing and dance. And I will say that, you know, as I talked about how we inscribe on the landscape of children's bodies who they are as Indigenous people and their role within creation, that's how we do it, with songs and dancing and singing and ceremonies, pipe ceremonies, for example. I don't know where I was going to go with that. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, one of the things that you talk about in some of your writings is the distinction, and you've talked about it a little bit earlier in the show, is the distinction between the circle of the mind and the circle of the heart. And, you know, I think the circle of the mind may be more self-evident, but maybe you could give examples of how we can access both in integration, because, you know, what you're really saying is that unless we use them both together and learn to do that, you know, we're acting from incomplete knowledge. And yet I think that the cultural beliefs and the experience of living in a culture that, you know, values profits above all else, you know, has created compliance or fragmentation within people where they don't know how to navigate and recreate that wholeness and connection within themselves and within their communities. And so I, you know, would be very interested in both your journey and your, you know, sense of how that can be recovered and healed.
Yes, thanks for bringing me back to that. Yes, in the book I offer a couple of models, and one of them is this idea of in order for there to be a truth, you have to have both mind knowledge and heart knowledge, the circle of mind knowledge and the circle of heart knowledge, and they have to be connected in order for there to be a truth. If one of those circles is missing, then you don't have a truth. And so I guess a good example of that is when I was doing my PhD work on the Algonquin land claim process, I had the emotional embodied knowledge of who I was as an Algonquin, but I didn't have an intellectual understanding. So that became my methodological theory, this idea of Debwaywin journey. Debwaywin means the truth that's in your heart. And so I went on a journey to come to and to establish the circle of intellectual knowledge and connect it to the heart, my heart knowledge. And so that's the way I moved. I moved from heart to head. And when I was talking, I've talked about this with other people, and I know somebody who's not a person of color, a white person, say that they were thought, they were so proud of themselves because they thought they were an expert on race theory. They knew, they read all the books and knew all the great thinkers, and they knew all the constructs. But they said it wasn't until they were in a context where they were the only white person that they fully understood racism, because they had the emotional element now of racism because they were the only white person in the room. So if you only have the intellectual circle of knowledge or the heart circle of knowledge, you don't have a full truth. And that's Anishinaabe. There's an Anishinaabe scroll for that, and it's an Anishinaabe teaching. And what I did is I pulled it into the academy and said, this is my theory of knowing, and it's I really like it. I think that's probably one of the smartest things I'll do in my lifetime is talk about heart knowledge, although I was quite reluctant to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. It's basically, there are people who maybe are out of touch completely with heart knowledge, or they are awake to it within a very narrow circle of some kind, so that it doesn't, a circle of concern. They kind of focus it there, and maybe it doesn't extend to, all living beings, yeah. People, or, the earth more broadly. It's kind of focused. And then maybe there's some people who are just kind of numb because of painful or traumatic experiences where, they haven't experienced any safety around that.
Yeah, I was reluctant to use it because I felt like it would be dismissed as women's knowledge, and I felt like I wanted something more rigorous. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the heart is incredibly intelligent. And I kept being exposed to teachings about heart knowledge. So, for example, I heard an elder say that when we speak to one another, we look at each other's face so that we experience each other's emotions. And there's a physiological synchronization between the emotions being expressed. And that's how we learn, through that embodiment of the emotions and that physiological synchronization. And then I heard another teaching from another elder say that, the longest journey is the one between your heart and your mind. And so I kept getting exposed to these heart knowledge teachings, and I slowly realized that they're really quite profound and phenomenal. And I walked into it, and I just said, this is what I'm going to do. And I guess what I also like to say about the heart knowledge is that in its anthropomorphic form, the human spirit moves through the heart first. And that makes sense, because we're after conception, we're a heart first, right? And what I also like to say is that morality takes the same pathway through the heart. So we should be angry when it comes to issues of social injustice, and not be pressured to be nice people, or not be pressured to only listen to nice knowledge, because morals move through the heart, and there's a lot of good reasons to be angry and pissed off about what's going on with the land and water. When this happens to me a lot, when people come along and they don't like the cognitive dissonance they're experiencing, or they don't like the fact that I'm going to be genuine with them and not couch my knowledge in the need to be nice, a lot of people get very upset with that. And I like to remind people that nice people, they are quite manipulative.
How so?
Well, first of all, politicians are always nice, or try to be nice. Pedophiles are always nice, right? That's how they groom the children. Employers are always nice, and employers, I will say, and politicians, they like nice, obliging, accommodating people. And so we really need to deconstruct and decolonize what is nice. And so what I guess, to bring it back to heart knowledge, is this: we can't be romantic about heart knowledge. Oh, I'm only going to go listen to this person because they make me feel happy and they bring the sunshine in my life. And it's no, you still have to go get that intellectual component of how you're feeling. Otherwise, you're probably most likely being manipulated and lied to or deceived.
Yeah, that's really an interesting challenge, because in other words, that's the way that we help sift through and integrate what the mind knowledge is telling us with what the heart knowledge may be saying, or we may need to develop the heart knowledge. I think many women in particular have strength in relying on the heart knowledge, but that can also lead people astray. And that's something, that we have to take responsibility for as well as look at the social factors that kind of, make that make that happen. You know, I don't think that, you know, we're in a situation where there's tremendous power overreach at the highest levels of government. And how do you speak to that? I mean, you know, you can try to put icing on it, but, you know, confronting that in any way is not going to be something that's welcomed, even if, you know, you come forth with a big smile on your face when you try to, you know, get through these kinds of imbalances. And yet I also feel that because people are so traumatized by all of these occurrences over centuries, over the last century, over their lifetimes recently, you know, that we also can get to a level of sort of rage and impotence. And we can see this internationally as well, where, you know, where we are ourselves at risk to become perpetrators because, you know, most perpetrators were once in some position of being victimized, on a, at least on an interpersonal psychodynamic level. On the other hand, there are whole segments of the population who are perpetrators because they've been privileged to become them. And that's on the social level.
Yeah, so just to say, talk about people who have been traumatized, that whole, if you are been harmed as a child, that knowledge is who you are, and that's who you become in times of stress, and it can go on if you don't really reflect on how you've been traumatized forever. Now, the thing is about heart knowledge is that, as I've been saying, the heart's really intelligent, and it can go on for generations in a way that, you know, a third generation will experience trauma but not know what its source was. So they do have to go on a journey, And then I think also, I find that a lot of people are willing to, in the economic paradigm, politicians, for example, they're willing to bend their morals for a political appointment or for employment. And this is a real issue, right? I think this is the nature of the economic paradigm. A lot of people are not willing to work outside of it and stay true to their morals or true to their values. All too often I've seen people being bending their morals for their own purposes and their own ego. Mm-hmm. And some of them think, oh, well, I'm going to make a difference on the inside, right?
Mm-hmm. So, they go in with that, and then, you know, it's a little bit here and a little bit there, and, you know, I mean, there's a story of a man who had two wives, and one was younger and one was older, and the, you know, younger wife was picking out all of his gray hairs, and the older wife was picking out all his dark hairs, and he wound up bald. And, you know, that kind of reminds me of the politician who goes in with a good intention, but, you know, kind of winds up bald, because, you know, he gradually has to, in the name of compromise, give up the farm, so to speak. You know, we only have about 10 minutes left at this point, and I just wanted to ask you just to kind of give us, not too extended a discussion, your view of intersectionality, because I think it's, the way you hold that is really helpful, and I think a lot, you know, people are confused by it, and yet it's a key factor and perspective in, you know, what we're dealing with and what the choices that we make as a society.
So I think intersectional feminism was a very valid and legitimate critique to old, what I call old white feminism. So people, women, were oppressed not just because of the color of our skin or because not just because we're women, but when you add color and issues of disability and issues of gender to it, the structural oppression becomes compounded and actually greater than the sum of its parts because, like drugs, they interact with the structural oppressions, interact with one another. And so a person with a disability, a woman with a disability who's also a person of color, will have much more stress navigating the structures of society, and they're going to be frustrated and sad and depressed and miserable. And what I think is really important there is white feminists shouldn't be judging those women for that valid expression of their emotions. And I think what's really important for white feminism is they have to stand behind people who are women who are structurally oppressed under more layers. That the for example, the black woman in a wheelchair has to lead the way. She will. No one will be free unless she's liberated. And so I find that white feminism isn't really valuing intersectional oppression the way it should be. And part of that means that they have to understand that within black societies or communities or indigenous communities, I should just speak there, there's going to be a lot of lateral violence and internalized oppression and infighting. And politicians actually will prevent people from supporting, for example, supporting the work I do. And so they really need to use critical theory in looking at how women of color are more isolated or more emotional in expressing what's going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Here in the States, and I don't know if it's true in Canada, but the momentum of looking at sexism and patriarchy and predation has really been not what you're describing, but more of a, at least as it's, you know, kind of shown out on the national media landscape, it's been more a matter of actually younger white women who have experienced harassing behavior, sexual harassment in the workplace, that has been, you know, or in their personal lives, you know, in a certain social niche, that has really been the group that has been kind of leading the parade on the critique of sexism and in a patriarchal culture. And you know, I'd just be curious, and if it's kind of putting you in a hot seat and you don't want to talk about it, that's okay too. But, you know, that doesn't fit what you're describing as the better model for true intersectionality, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, I think it's important for white women to do the work that they're doing, and I think that certainly it shows that not much has changed. This idea that things have changed for women, I don't see that. But I think that white feminists need to consciously really think about how are they serving women of color and how are they serving women with disabilities. That's all. I think that's what I have to say about that. I'm not saying that white women don't have something to be protesting about. Of course they do.
Mm-hmm. But more in terms of their organization and attention. Well, you know, that's, I think that's, you know, a very valid understanding. You know, what do you work with people with decolonizing or, you know, their understanding, whether you know, are there any groups? Do you have any counsel or recommendations for different groups about how to decolonize your mind? You know, that being a theme of your book. And I just want to mention also, we're speaking with Lynn Gale today. She's the author of Claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit. You can find her book and, you know, links to purchase her book, as well as many articles and public appearances and talks and podcasts that she's participated in on Lynn's website, which is Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Gale, G-E-H-L.com. So I just want to make sure that listeners know how they can read more deeply and follow Lynn's work through her website, as well as her Facebook page, Dr. Lynn Gale, Algonquin Anishinaabe. But, you know, what are your recommendations about decolonizing the human spirit? You know, I know we've touched on many throughout the program, but are there any further ones that, you know, where people can begin to do this self-reflection or community work that will help, you know, them decolonize?
Yeah, so what I like to say is that we're all indigenous to the earth, and we all have indigenous knowledge. Indigenous people of Turtle Island don't have the monopoly on it. We all had earth-based knowledge before capitalism and before materialism, and we need to return to that knowledge and the ceremony and rituals associated with it. Otherwise, Canada and the United States will continue to colonize our hearts through actually a national anthem. And isn't that an interesting concept, that we were all being colonized and manipulated through song, one song in particular? Mm-hmm. It speaks to the power of song, right? And it speaks to understanding why Indigenous people value song as a way of shaping who we are. Unfortunately, nation states are manipulating our hearts and manipulating our spirits through one song. So I think that's what people, we need to do, is we all need to move back to our Indigenous knowledge and find and rediscover reverence for the earth. And we need to do it really consciously with our children, because we don't have it in our bodies. We have to work a little extra harder at it, and we need to bring our children to the land and to the water and teach them reverence for it through song, dance, and ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And some people actually think that when I talk about singing and dancing and for the land and water, I'm not talking about how singing will cause the pollution to settle into the settlement. What I mean by that is it's going to embody within our children the importance of water.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a teachable moment. We have to embody it within our children.
Mm-hmm. And ourselves too. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, when you're talking about the song "O Canada," I'm remembering battle hymn of the Republic. I mean, the American, and the Star Spangled Banner. You know, the American anthems are, you know, war and drinking songs. You know, my mother always pointed that out when I was a kid, that she wasn't a fan. Through being repeated over and over, if we hear the same thing, and this is what happens in the media too, we imbibe that. So we have to also consciously be returning, as you're saying, to more natural and human ways and, you know, reteaching ourselves and embodying that. So I think that's, you know, that's really, really important. What do you have upcoming? What are you next involved with or working on, along the way? Like, what are you actively working on now or next, or, you know?
I think I've been helping a friend decommission her farm, but I think I'm doing like a little bit of a book tour. I have the Lakefield Literary Festival here in Ontario, and then in Quebec I'm going to the Wakefield Library to have a public talk about my book. So it's mostly just talks.
And aren't you up for an award, a book award, soon?
Oh, I think there's an Indies Award in June 15th. I'll find out if I receive that. And I recently, my book received the Saskatchewan Publishers Book Award in Culture.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then
we're talking again, listeners, about claiming Anishinaabe, Decolonizing the Human Spirit, Lynn Gale's current book, and her previous book, The Truth That Wampum Tells, My Dibawan on the Algonquin Land Claims Process. And they're both, you can find links to purchase and read sections of both books, as well as Lynn's other blogs and appearances on her website, lynngehl.com. So, you know, thank you, you know, so much for being with us today here on Connect the Dots. I think this is what you're presenting is a different pathway toward dealing with the tremendous challenges that we see before us, and the sense that we can get there more fully and completely by reincorporating these neglected or rejected or denied parts of our heart, our morality, our spirit, our ethics, that, you know, we've had to, many people have kind of sacrificed or put to one side. You know, one of the things that struck me also in your story is the theme of belonging and unworthiness. I think people very often subscribe to popular conformist attitudes because they, you know, everyone else is saying them and they want to belong and they're afraid to deviate. And they are not as willing as you have been to stand alone and really examine both the systems and their own heart. And, you know, I think you're really an amazing model of that combination of things as a path forward. I think it's really needed, too.
Thank you. That's a compliment. I think I was just doing what I needed to do in order to survive, and I came to some really valid and profound knowledge. And I'm grateful to have learned the sophisticated nature of indigenous knowledge, and I'm grateful that that is the bundle I will take with me as I leave the Western doorway.
That's really beautifully said. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Dr. Lynn Gale. Prayers and good wishes for your ongoing and, you know, amazing work. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Till next week, when we meet again for our next program, reminding everyone, you know, to, even in these challenging times, head up, heart open, keep marching forward with all our relations in connection. Thank you for joining us today and every week on Connect the Dots. And thank you.